Good evening. If you want to be opening in your Bibles to Colossians chapter 3, that's where we will begin in just a moment. I had Ken mention this morning in the announcements that gentleman Larry, Nancy Weber's brother, had passed away. Got a bunch of texts from them this afternoon. Because he was found unresponsive, he's only 57, because he was found unresponsive and had been that way for, I guess, 10 minutes or longer, and he was in a public facility like a hospital or a rehab center or something, they're deeming it a suspicious death and doing an autopsy. And so that just, obviously, those kind of things just make it harder on the family. Doing an autopsy, the police department's involved, so they probably won't even release the body, they said, for days. And they're hoping to be able to have a funeral by this next weekend. And then about as quick as they sent those texts, sent another text, David, her husband's father, was taken to the hospital unresponsive this afternoon and is not doing well. So Judy and I were talking about that. It just seems like sometimes families hit just a wave of things, and that certainly has happened to them. So David and Nancy Weber, if you keep them in your prayers, I know that they would certainly appreciate that. I'm going to ask Mason, if he would, to lead us in prayer before we start the class. Amen. All right, Colossians chapter 3, as we mentioned, we're actually going to be looking, starting around verse 12 this evening, and only going through about verse 17, which is what is scheduled for this class anyway, this particular time period. And it doesn't seem like a lot of verses, but there's quite a bit said in those verses. We want to take just a little bit of time to talk about that. As Paul has started to make, in a very practical sense, his arguments regarding the preeminence of Christ and how we know whether or not Christ is indeed preeminent in our lives. By the time you get to verse 18, he's going to start going into very particular situations, not so much character as he's doing here, but into particular situations where he stops about home relationships, or where he starts with home relationships and whether or not Christ is preeminent in our home relationships. But prior to that, he has told us already, as we backed up into that section that we looked at last time, he used the terminology that told us that there are things that we need to put off and put on. Just for a moment, what do you get out of the significance of that phraseology that he uses? What does that help you to understand about the nature of us serving Christ? Yeah, great point. There's a voluntary. This is my choice as to whether or not I'm going to do this, both the putting off and the putting on. There's a change, and what kind of change? How would you describe the change? All right, absolutely. Yeah, you're going to be different in character. You're going to look different. You're going to act different than you did before. Yeah, your life is going to look completely different. Diane? Yeah, he's describing it like clothes, but obviously it's not something that's external only. It is what we are becoming. Put this on in our lives. Other things. There's a complete renewal, and I think that's a key as well here, that there's more than just that I'm changing things. It's more a matter of, you know what, here's the old self. God doesn't say, you know what, you need to start working on changing the old self. Though we do that. Remember, we talked about he uses two words for new in this letter. He uses the word neo, which means new one time, just brand new. It's just replaced with something new. But then he uses the word kainos in the Greek, which is renewing, which is an ongoing process. So there is a sense in which we're constantly adapting and changing our lives. But he says the process starts by a complete removal of one and it being replaced with the new. And I think that's important. It isn't a matter of him saying, you know what, you need to tweak yourself a little bit here and tweak yourself a little bit here. I remember that with my mom, because she didn't become a Christian until, how many years after we were married, would you say, Jude? She was 68, I think, right? I think she was 68 when she became a Christian. So we'd been married a long time already before my mom became a Christian. And I had made the same argument with people and with her over and over. I said, Mom, I mean, because she was angelic as far as her demeanor and behavior. She was as moral as a person could possibly be, even if you were striving to serve Christ, which she wasn't. And so I would say things like, Mom, there's so little that you have to change. You just need to make these little alterations in your life. But it wasn't until I came to a conclusion much later that I approached that differently with her, and that wasn't the truth. She needed to change every single thing in her life, the motivation for it. Nothing that she was doing was she doing because it was motivated by Jesus Christ. And how did he start this whole section out? Why is it that you're getting rid of the old life and putting on the new life? What's his motivation, he says, for this? He talks about being dead in sin, and that's where we were before. We're going to appear with him in glory. Even before he mentions the appearing with him in glory, he says what? He starts this whole chapter out by saying what? If you've been raised with Christ, if this is who you are, if what you're claiming is to be a Christian, he says, then this is the way you ought to be living. You ought to put away that entire old self so that you can put on this new self. He's saying there's a motivation for that. And I mention that because we're going to go back to Ephesians 4 a little bit later in the lesson and look at the similar motivation that Paul uses with the Ephesians. It's very similar in its structure when he's saying, look, your life has to be different than it was before. And we're not talking about a little tweak here, a little tweak there. As a matter of fact, to the Romans, Paul says it's what? What symbology does he use in Romans to describe what's happening? You've died, he says, completely. The old life is gone. It's dead. You're starting new. That doesn't mean you won't have to work and you won't have to continue to strive to improve in that relationship. But he's saying that's a decision that's made that is a death of one and a renewal of the other. So that's kind of the idea when he's talking about this change of clothing, that it is, it's not, well, you know what, I just need to have a shirt that looks a little better with the pants kind of thing. It is, he's saying, you're stripping off everything that's old and putting on brand new. And that's the life. And in this section, starting in verse 12, he says, therefore is the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering, bearing with one another and forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, so you also must do. But above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. And let the peace of God rule in your hearts, to which also you were called in one body, and be thankful. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly, in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord. And whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him. So, let's just look at what he says in here, because he's just going to give a whole list of things that he's talking about that we need to put on, behaviors that we need to replace those ones that we put off before, when he talked about the things that we've kind of stripped out of our life. And he's going to say, here are the things you need to put on. And I think there's some uniqueness to not only the things individually that he says, but this list looks similar to some other list as far as what exactly is it that he's describing. But before we talk about the put on itself, because he's going to start with put on, but then he's going to kind of put in that parenthetical phrase there in the sense of what's before it and after it, really, you could take the phrase and put it in the beginning. He says, this is what's important first. Here's the motivation. He says, as God's chosen. So what does that mean to you? He said, because that's what he tells us here. He's going to say, as God's chosen. He's going to say, holy. And what else? And beloved. All right, so what do those things mean to you? In other words, if Paul is saying, here's what I'm asking you to do. Here's the motivating force behind this. If you've been raised with Christ, now as God's chosen, so what does that mean to you?
That we belong to God.
That we belong to God, absolutely. Yeah, Rob?
I think so, those two things, we're holy because we've been sanctified by Christ, and we're beloved, we're part of Christ's family
now. Oh, absolutely, and that word holy means to be sanctified or to be set apart. You are, because you're God's chosen and you are set apart, you are different. I mean, how many times has Ken mentioned in some of the Old Testament classes that we've looked at how important it was that God was trying to get the people to understand you are not like the world. You have to be different than the world in the way that you think, in the way that you act. And so, and that group of people that he was talking to in the Old Testament was whom? Or who? The nation of Israel, which were the chosen ones. It's same idea. Some of the terminology that he uses in this section very much are Old Testament terminology as well. I mean, these things were applied in the Old Testament just like they are in the New. And he's saying, just like they were the chosen, and because they were the chosen ones of God, in the sense of now they were chosen for the purpose of bringing the Savior through, but because they were that chosen nation, God had some expectations of them, didn't he? He provided them some great blessings, but he had expectations of them because they were his people, and he talked about these people. And same way with us. He's saying, you are God's chosen. Understand that. Should that make you feel good?
Of course.
Yeah, absolutely we should feel good. That God has provided an opportunity for us to be his chosen people today, the same as he did then. Now, theirs was through physical birth. They were a part of that nation that were the chosen nation. Ours is through spiritual birth, but he says that's the way we become. And so you think about being chosen, you think about being set apart or sanctified. Beloved really is translated very easily, dearly loved. So what does that mean to you when God says, as God's dearly loved people? Does that help motivation-wise?
We're special.
We are special, and we read that in other places, don't we? When we talk about being a peculiar people, a special people. Again, I mean, several authors use the same kind of terminology to help us understand who we are. I think that's important because I think it's the best motivating factor that exists. Yeah, great point. The idea of beloved, if you didn't hear that, Ben was saying it's a familial term, a term you would use of your very close family. My dearly beloved, you know, remember when God was speaking, this is my, what, as he spoke of Jesus? My beloved son. He says, hear ye him. This is my dear son. He says, that's who we are. We are the dear ones, the loved ones of God. Have you ever used that motivation with your kids? to try to get them to understand that based on their relationship to you, they should behave a certain way? I mean, obviously their relationship to God as well. But don't we do that with our children? To try to help them understand how special they are in our lives and why it's so important for us to get them to go a certain direction because they mean the world to us here. He's saying that's who we are. As God's chosen, holy, this set-apart group, the dearly beloved of God. So what's the first thing he tells them that they ought to put on? Compassionate hearts. Why? What's that? Absolutely, he was compassionate.
We have the love of our hearts.
And we have to have the love, because here's what he's going to start to do. You're going to start to see identifying marks. He's trying to paint a picture here, I think. And so you think in terms of compassionate hearts. You think about Jesus in Matthew chapter 9, as well as a bunch of other places, when it talked about why he was doing what he did. I mean, he healed a lot of sick people, didn't he? Some of it was to prove who he was. And he talks about that. But sometimes it says he looked on the crowd and what? He felt compassion. That's who Jesus was. Absolutely, Jesus is an example. It hurt him when he looked at hurting people, didn't it? That's the whole idea. Compassion is a true heartfelt concern for other people. And so, as he's going to be talking about here, being brought into this body of people, because he's going to talk about that a little bit later, the whole unity of this body and all the things that go together. He's going to say, what's critical to have? To have a unity in a body like this, at Bull Verde, for this group to be unified and God-driven, is it not critical that we are compassionate and that we have compassionate hearts? That we have the ability to enter into somebody else's situation, that we can feel empathy for other people. We hurt because they hurt. God says that in other places, doesn't he? What's he tell us in other places regarding that kind of tie and emotion with each other? Absolutely. He says, you know, and it isn't crying for them. It isn't rejoicing for them, though you might do both. It's rejoicing with them, weeping with them. It is that empathetic approach because, you know what? You're happy, I'm happy. You hurt, I hurt. We understand that in the most close of our relationships, do we not? Have you ever had somebody else that's so close to you that they hurt and you actually hurt because of that? You actually feel nausea or sickness or whatever else it is because of what they're going through? He's saying that's what ought to happen to all of us in regards to how much compassion we have for one another. And he says, so that's where we're going to start. You're getting rid of the old self. Let me tell you, the first thing to put on is compassion, because it becomes a driving force for everything else about our relationship with each other. So put on compassionate hearts. But then he says kindness. So what does that mean to you? What does it mean to put on kindness? What's that?
To be always good with
them. To be good with other people? How do you describe? How is it that you strive to have kindness? What do you think of when you think of... You might think of charitable and hospitable toward other people. Absolutely. You're willing to help. You ever think, you know, there's some words that are easier maybe to describe by the opposite side of the equation. So what is this person not? What are you not displaying if you're kind? You're not displaying the kind of anger that disturbs other people. Remember, now we talked about there's an anger that's righteous over sin, and we talked about we ought to feel that way, but toward people and how we react toward them. Am I displaying anger toward them, or am I displaying kindness toward them? Am I harsh or not harsh? Let me ask you, have you met anybody that's unkind? They're just unkind. Well, we can identify them, can't we? Yeah, you absolutely are trying to be in someone else's place. I think it's the capacity to show grace. It's not hard to be kind to the person that's always kind to you. We're kind toward others. Let me go to Joe first, and then I'll come to Diane.
It's an action item.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's almost like he starts with the feeling, be compassionate and therefore be kind. Do for them. Show them grace in what you're doing. Diane? Which he's going to speak specifically to that idea as well before we get to the end of it. Yeah, Ken?
It also, you know, it's this comparison verses 5 and 8, all the things that you get rid of, and now you're starting on this list to build up. You have to have something in your heart. You can't be just an empty vessel. And so you've gotten rid of all of these other things. If you don't fill it up with the right stuff, then it's kind of like the one who had, you know, had to be in the left and had house and stuff to clean, and then after you came in, it was up a little worse. So this is the replacement, and it's the opposite of what you had in verse 5.
Yeah, good point. And so as we think about getting rid of things, the whole point seems to be Christianity is not an issue of what you've gotten rid of and what you're not doing. That's a part of the picture. But Christianity has to be fulfilled. The picture has to be filled by what are we doing? Christianity is a positive thing. It is an action, as Joe's saying, it's an action. It's an active thing. What are we doing? It's not only what do I abstain from. You know what? I did away with all of those things. What are you doing? Well, I'm not doing anything, but I did away with all of those. He's saying that's not the way it is. Then he says, put on humility. You ever think about that? How do you put on humility? I'm going to work hard at becoming a more humble person. It just doesn't seem to fit as you even think about it, does it? How do you put on humility? And what do you understand by the very command to put on humility? Yeah, Deb? Yeah, great point. It's going to be how am I getting my viewpoint of self? Because I think honesty with self or about self is going to be the absolute key to humility. Am I going to get the right viewpoint of myself? And I cannot get that by looking around me. I can't. Now, there may be people around me that are better than me. I shouldn't even say there may be. There are people around me that are better than me. But those aren't typically the people that we're looking at to make the comparisons. We do look at others. Ben? Yeah, great point. And that's why I'm saying, so why is it in this list? He tells you to put it on? Because you can. You can put on humility. You can change that aspect of your life if you get the right viewpoint. And I think Deb's exactly on point when she says, it's a matter of me always making the right comparison. Let me look at myself, where I am, and look at God and where he wants me. Not only where he is, because if I'm looking at where he is, then I'm never going to see myself even remotely of any worth at all. But even if I look at, if I drop that standard and say, not where he is, but where he's asking me to be, I'm still not even there. Either way, if I look at God's standards or God, then I'm getting a better viewpoint of myself and understanding. What kind of things cause us not to do that? What do you think causes us not to do that, to make those comparisons of other people?
Pride.
What's that?
Pride.
Oh, yeah, pride is, which is obviously the opposite of humility. Yeah, any of the vanity that we have. I've mentioned before, I love that button that one guy had on. Says, my humility is exceeded only by my ability to express it. You know, how do we view ourselves in all of that? And he says, put on humility. Constantly look at yourself and where you stand with God and where God is. And the holiness of God compared to your own holiness. The righteousness of God compared to your own righteousness. He says, if I keep that perspective right, I have a better view. And is there an advantage of me having the right view of myself, even in regards to my relationship with you? Where's the advantage of that? Well, others may see that in me, and so they may see that and learn and appreciate that. Penny? And so as we talk about having the mind of Christ, which he's talked about here already, when we're thinking about those things above, when we've got the right viewpoint, when we've got the right motivation, we're trying to be Christ-like. Think back to the first beatitude. What was the first beatitude? Blessed are the poor in spirit. He knows if he can get your view of you right first. And that makes a difference even in my relationships with other people. Because I understand, you know what? My problem that I'm suffering with and that I'm struggling with may not be the same problem you're struggling with, but it is no less the problem. And so it causes me, if I've got the right viewpoint of self, it causes me not to be overly judgmental toward other people as well. And I get a better picture. So he says, put on humility. What about when he talks about meekness, or some versions say gentleness? What do you think of with meekness or gentleness? Different than kindness. A quiet spirit in the way it behaves. Yeah, Rob? A great deal, especially when you think of meekness. There's a great deal of strength in there. It's not a person being soft, but it is a person having a soft touch, isn't it? I remember when we had our first child, and I watched the doctors and the nurses deal with the kids in the nursery because I had a totally different opinion as to how breakable they were, apparently. As you watch the doctors and the nurses flipping them over and grabbing them by the ankles and picking them up to change, you know, you're thinking, oh, what are you doing? You're going to tear this child apart. And you learn they're not quite as fragile as you think they are when they're born, and they move them around that way. But you still have to have a very gentle touch, don't you? It doesn't take much to bruise the child. You still have to have the strength to deal with, but you got to be gentle with them. How was Jesus described regarding gentle? How did Isaiah describe him? That's one of the great pictures of gentleness probably in the scriptures or anywhere. We certainly think of him as a lamb. So he's a sheep before it shears as far as the willingness to go ahead and go toward whatever he was headed toward. Remember Isaiah talking about plant life? And he said, think about a reed. And how did he describe him? Anybody, how familiar are you with reeds? You know, those of us who grew up in Florida, a lot of reeds. They look pretty cool. What are they not good for? Give me something that a reed's not going to be good for. You can't hit something with it because it's just going to fold right in half and it's not going to do anything. You know, they looked like they would make some great little fishing poles when we were growing up, but you can't make a fishing pole out of it because you hook a line and a weight on the end and the reed just over. And it says of Jesus what? Even if you've got a reed that's bruised, I mean, it's ready to go. And it said, but Jesus what? He wouldn't even break that reed. He was gentle enough that he had the ability to handle with that tender care. And he says, we need to understand that. Why? Why is it critical to have that kind of gentleness? Oh, absolutely. You can't convert people by being harsh. That's just going to be an approach that is non-effective with them. What about even within our own brethren? Why is it so important to have gentleness among you? Yeah, Rob?
We have to understand that we're all at a different place in our faith and our lives, and understanding
of Christ. Yeah, great point. Go ahead, Mason, then I'll say something. Yeah, great point. And some much more fragile than others, wouldn't you agree? Because of, like Rob saying, who knows where we are in our life? Who knows what's going on in our life? You take somebody that's like this family that I mentioned, the Webbers, and what they're going through. Those are the kind of things that make you a little more fragile. You may react differently to some things. I didn't mention some other things about them. They've got a daughter, Katie, that's 18. She's got spina bifida. She's had over 45 surgeries. She's 18. She's had over 45 surgeries. It's mind-boggling to me to think what she has gone through and how upbeat she is all the time and that kind of thing. But I'm saying a family that's constantly in the hospital and constantly going through turmoil, There's some fragility there. There are things going on in people's home lives that make people more fragile. And he's saying, you're going to have to be gentle. And he's going to tell us why all of that is. And then he says, you're going to need patience. And we certainly understand that. We're not great with patience. Things that make us impatient. Why would you say? Why do we struggle with patience? In our culture, in our society. Things don't go the way that we want them to. It just seems like Murphy's Law is in constant application to our lives. We want instant gratification. We're in a hurry. Would you agree with that? As a culture, we're in a hurry a lot of times. And then when you're in a hurry, you think about the other things that go with that. Because you're in a hurry or because you're extremely busy, and then we find ourselves being a little bit late. I've noticed when I go to the airport, you know, if you arrive at the airport 2 hours early and you're standing in line that you know is going to take 15 minutes to get through, it doesn't seem to have the same effect on you as when you get to the airport an hour early and you're standing in line that's going to take 15 minutes to get through. You start getting a little more anxious the later you run. We're busy, we're in a hurry, we're late, and we don't have the patience that we should. And he says patience is absolutely needed because of what? What is it he's going to ask us to do next? What's that? Forgive one another, and before he even forgive one another, he says what? He says, bear with one another and forgive one another. He says, you know what? You're going to have to be patient. We talk about that at marriage retreats. It takes patience. This is the statement I make, which is seldom taken right or properly. It takes patience to live with my wife. So you can understand why that's not normally taken very well. But I make the point after that, but it takes more patience to live with me. I mean, I don't care who you are. It's going to take patience to live with your spouse. Why? Because they're imperfect. All of a sudden, here we are in this group of imperfect people. As Mason said, this bunch of bruised reeds, and we struggle with all kinds of issues, and we don't even know the issues that so many people are struggling with. He says, you're going to have to be patient because you're going to have to bear up with one another. Not always is everybody going to act exactly the way they should, say exactly the things that they should say. He says, so, but you got to bear with one another. You got to forgive one another. And how do you forgive them, did he say? How? What was the description of how to do that here? The same way the Lord forgave you. How hard is that? How did the Lord, somebody describe to me how the Lord forgave you. When you didn't ask for it, when you didn't care, what else did I hear? He gave his life for us. The ultimate sacrifice in order to bring about the forgiveness. Other things about the forgiveness of the Lord. It's permanent, absolutely. He wiped it away. He says, as far as the east is from the west, like the depths of the sea, it's gone completely. What did you say, Nina? It's complete. Total. You know, it's not like you're going to the Lord and saying, Lord, I've been incredibly good, but I did this one thing. And if you'll just forgive me of that one thing. When I came to the Lord and was baptized into Christ, I would have hated anybody to have assigned me the task and say, what you need to do is list your sins that he's forgiving you of. That would have been extremely difficult because I knew there were a host of those things. But God says, not only are they gone completely away, they're all gone. No matter what they were, they're all gone. He says, that's the way that we need to forgive one another. Forgiveness needs to be total. It needs to be complete. It needs to be unconditional in that sense. It doesn't happen only because the person is worthy of that. They're not worthy of that at all. It's given to them in a completely undeserving state. He says, but we need to be forgiving like Christ was forgiving. And then he brings in that all-encompassing. He says, and above everything else, he's not really saying so much that, you know, like this is the list. Let's just put this one at the top of the list. It seems to be more all encompassing than that. He says love is the very thing that holds all of it together. What kind of love? Yeah, unconditional has to be one of the first words that comes out, doesn't it? This isn't what I feel. This is what I do, isn't it? Love needs to be in deed. It's not just in word. It's in deed. I'm living it out. It's not based on always even how I feel. You know, can you imagine if our relationship with God was based on how he felt emotionally? Now, he doesn't feel like we do in that sense, but I'm saying if it was based on a feeling, but it wasn't. While we were yet sinners, there's nothing about that statement that would make you feel like God's saying, I just feel good about these people. These people are endearing. He says, no, while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. That's the nature of the love that he has for us. And he says that becomes that umbrella. And he uses that concept in other places, doesn't he? Remember when he talks about the great commandment? He says, love your God, all your heart, soul, mind, strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. And then he makes the statement of what? Upon these two, all the law and the prophets hang. He said every single thing else he ever told his people falls somewhere underneath that umbrella. That's how big that is. Loving God and loving man like God loves man. He says that's an umbrella large enough to cover all of that. I thought I saw him. Oh, yeah, Ken? Yeah, good point. We need to take that on a Wednesday night. We will. We'll tackle that. Exactly what constitutes the forgiveness that God asks us to provide. Because not only motivation, but exactly how it's executed and to whom it's executed, all of those things are very valid questions. And what it is that's even happening, I think that's part of the equation that we sometimes leave out of there. But he says all of this is critical, and this love, he says, which is the bond of perfection. He says it's going to bring everything to its completeness. It holds it all together. Yeah, Ken?
Yeah.
Yeah, good point. It fills those gaps. That's a great way of illustrating that. That it is the glue that will bring that bond to absolute completion. And he's going to continue to talk about this unity as he works his way through. He goes from there to say, let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts. Why? And what is the peace of Christ ruling in your hearts? Where else do we see that? The peace of Christ or the peace of God. You remember what Paul said to the Philippians? He says, as we're going to, the peace that passes understanding is going to guard our hearts when we let God be in charge, when we turn it all over to him. And he says, that's the peace that allows us to rest. And I think he's saying, that's going to provide for something. Why is it critical in this passage that the peace of Christ rule in your hearts? What did he say? Because we've what? We have been forgiven. Look at verse 15 there. Let the peace of God rule in your hearts, to which also you were called in one body. He says this is a whole part of this unity and the ability to be content with what we are and what God has made of us as a body. And he says, and be thankful. Be thankful that you've been called into this one body of this peace that God says that we can have. And he says, not only the peace of Christ ruling in you, but he says, be thankful in that. But he says, let the Word dwell in you. How does the Word dwell in you? And what does this passage sound similar to? When you look at Colossians 3:16, it sounds pretty familiar, doesn't it? I'm sorry, somebody did. Go ahead, Deb. Yeah, Ephesians 5:19, except he doesn't say the Word there. He says what? The Spirit dwelling in you. These things, I think, are just really saying the same thing. That the Word of Christ, that the Spirit of God, that Christ dwells in us, that God dwells in us. And he's saying, let God live inside of you to such a degree that you do what? Isn't it interesting? He says, let the Word dwell in you richly. And the first thing he tells you that should happen is what? We sing. teaching and admonishing one another in songs. What's he describing here? These two, this verse and verse in Ephesians 5 and 5:19, most commonly used for what, would you say, amongst our brethren? To talk about instrumental music. Now, I'm not saying they don't have an application there. They do, because he very specifically says in both places, sing, and I think that is very significant. But it doesn't appear that in either of these two passages that he's dealing with trying to govern what's going on in a collective assembly, does it? He's talking about our lives. He's not talking about coming together and singing like this. He's talking about, I'm telling you, you ought to be so full of God that you're singing. That should be your life. The joy ought to be coming out. And you're teaching and admonishing one another and singing songs and hymns and spiritual songs. That ought to be who we are. And he says that it ought to be who we are because it's dwelling in us richly to the point of overflowing. He says that ought to be who we are. People ought to see in Christians incredible expressions of joy. That's what they ought to see in Christians. Christians ought to be the most joyful, the most praising type of people, because God is dwelling in us that way. He says, let that dwell in you. And then, and with what? He says, with grace or with thankfulness. Again, teaching and singing, he says, with thankfulness. And then he finishes out the passage by saying what? Whatever you do, whatever you say, whatever you do, what should be the motivation? The gratitude because of who Christ is. He says, do it all in the name of Christ. All because that's what Christ is, because that's who he is. And once again, mentioning thankfulness. You realize that? He says, be thankful, thankful, thankful. Paul just hammers that point as to how grateful. Why is it critical to be grateful? Well, we certainly did nothing to deserve it. It certainly puts it in great perspective. I understand what that whole relationship is. Shows glory to God. Yeah, it does. The entire equation breaks down. Thankfulness is the big motivator. When I truly appreciate, what's it take for people to be the absolute best servants of God they can ever be is to completely appreciate what God has done. I don't care who the preacher is or the teacher is. You could try to beat motivation into people all day long, every week of the year, and not gain what needs to be gained if one person just understands God did this for me. I am so grateful. How could I do anything but give my entire life for him? He says that's how he's trying to motivate us. And that's how he starts all of this. He says, because you raised with Christ. That's who you are. Look back at Ephesians real quickly. I want to make one point out of there. And then the lesson is yours. Because he uses the same kind of motivation when he's talking about this idea. Ephesians talks also about putting off and putting on and that whole idea of the new man and the old man. He starts off in verse 17 saying, this I say therefore and testify to the Lord that you should no longer walk as the rest of the Gentiles walk in the futility of their mind. Having their understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that's in them, because of the blindness of their heart. He goes on to talk about them being past feeling and all the things that go with that. Then he talks about in verse 24, you put on the new man. But look what he says in verse 20. You have not learned Christ this way. That's not who you are. You have not so learned Christ. If indeed you have heard him and have been taught by him as truth is in Jesus, then you shall put off. Both are saying the same thing, aren't they? They're just saying, look, this is who you are. This is who you are. If this is who you are, this is how you ought to act. Both of them use the same motivation. And I think it's always been God's great motivator, whether it was Old Testament or New. God says, understand what I'm doing for you. That ought to be the driving force for what you do for me. Now, he's going to take that next into, so what kind of husband are you guys? What kind of wives are you, women? That's the next direction he takes that. Thanks for your attention and your comments.